We are at the third biennial conference of the International Mind Brain Education Society. It opened last night. We're at the Catamaran Resort in San Diego. And the opening plenary was given by Helen Neville, who's sitting with me right now, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And the title of your talk, which I'm going to ask you to unpack right now for a general audience, was Experiential Genetic and Epigenetic Effects on Human Neurocognitive Development. Now, we actually filmed the whole talk, so we have that.
Good.
But
I don't want to give it again.
Let's gloss it a little bit. Just give me that in layman's terms.
Well, what we've been studying for many years are the ways that input from the environment, that's what I mean by experience, impacts brain development. So that's what I mean by experiential
right.
effects on neurocognitive development. And neurocognitive development means brain and cognition, the ways, all the ways that we know the world. And we're also looking at genetic effects, because it turns out that people have the same genes, but they get different forms of them. And depending on which form of a gene, for example, genes important in neurotransmitters in the brain, like dopamine-related genes, serotonin-related genes, you can get one form of the serotonin gene or another form, and depending on which form you get, things are different for you. Both vulnerability to stress is different, IQs are different, and attention is different. So that's what I mean by genetic. And then the epigenetic means, is referring to the fact that, of course, gene expression is different in different environments. That's what an epigenetic effect is. And how it works is, epi means sits on, and so there are different methyl groups and things like that that sit on top of genes that either give rise to them being upregulated or downregulated. So that's what I mean by epigenetic. So I talked about all that last night. I talked about experiential, genetic, and epigenetic effects on neurocognitive development.
Yeah. Now, I think that when people pick up, there's a shrinking number of these sources that they can go to now, but if they read the Science Times in the New York Times, for example, or if they read some report of a paper in Science or Nature, it's a study that's been done on a certain limited population with a number of individuals and so on, mm-hmm. and you tend to think that that result applies to all those people in that study. In other words, this is a statement that could be made about humanity in general. What you've just been talking about is very different. It's almost a science of individuality. In other words, you can't make these blanket statements about certain things. Am I going too far there?
Yes.
Okay.
Because we couldn't have begun to look at individual differences, for example, in genes, until we knew the general pattern.
Okay.
Of course, there is a result that's more or less like this for monolingual right-handed, typically developing individuals. That's what I reported last night.
Right.
And on average, they're going to benefit from this kind of input. That's okay. And then, well, once we've got that result established, and that takes a long time to establish, and it's very important to establish points of departure like that. Mm-hmm. Because without them, you could not look at individual differences. So we have a general result and a general finding, and then now we can start pushing it around a bit, like, oh, does it look different? For example, if you have this form of the gene, well, yeah, it does. Then if you have this form, yes. So both are very important. It's just a question of emphasis and timing. You know, you can't do one without the other. And and the other thing is, will our result hold, for example, with Latino families? That's the next experiment we're doing.
Yeah.
It's important to do that. It's important to know the degree to which a result holds across different cultural groups, for example.
So one of the things that struck me very forcibly last night was, I've read a lot of work that's been written by Jim Heckman.
Good.
A well-known, obviously, Nobel Prize-winning economist at the University of Chicago. who's written a number of papers about poverty and the effects of poverty.
Yeah.
This is somebody you work with, I think, or at least knows work.
Yeah, he's one of our new best friends. Yeah.
And I wonder if you could talk about the poverty and the brain story.
Well, it's been actually very well established by several researchers for many years that children who live below the poverty line are much less capable at just about anything you want to measure than children who are living in a more higher socioeconomic status demographic. So this has been known. And what Jim Heckman, he's an economist, and he knows that our economy is in trouble.
Yeah.
And he's also been carefully following the results of something called the Perry Preschool Project. Perry Preschool Project that I spoke about last night. So in the 60s, people had a bit more money, I guess. So there were two programs for poor children that were developed and implemented. One of them was Perry Preschool. The other one was Abecedarian. They were expensive, but it involved daily child training and parent training and for 2 years. And, you know, like Abecedarian, I think, was $42,000 per child, and Perry Preschool was $14,000 per child. And so what Heckman's been, now they've been following up the children who were in those programs in the 60s.
Yeah.
Until today. So 50 years on, you can still see differences between children who are in the control groups versus children who got that input. Yeah. And there's a huge economic benefit as well as personal benefits to the individuals. But whereas kids in the control group, they end up going to jail usually. They're unemployed.
Mm.
Going through school, they had to repeat grades and had remedial education. Hey, this is a lot of money. Jail, remedial education, all that. Whereas the kids who had been in these good programs were graduated high school, had jobs, were paying taxes, weren't going to jail, didn't have to repeat grades. So it's just, you know, it's easy, you know? It's pretty straightforward. Now, Jim Heckman has been going around the country telling policymakers about this. He's advocating for investing in early education as a means of getting out of the economic recession.
Right, right.
In other words, you could help the children and the families. You could solve the economic problems. Who isn't going to buy this? That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
Who knows, man? I don't know why they're not buying it.
So
I do know. I know why. It's because it's not, they're not getting their money tomorrow.
Yeah.
And in this culture, in America, almost uniquely, the avarice for short-term gain, financial gain, is absolutely staggering and hideous. It's because they'd have to wait a few years before they'd get the benefit of their investment.
But having thought about the things that you've thought about over a very distinguished career.
Good question.
And suppose I deposed Arne Duncan tomorrow and made you Secretary of Education or something. I mean, what would you imagine telling people that you wanted to change about the school system, about the education system? I mean,
I would get,
you have a vision of this?
I mean, yeah, I sure I do. I mean, Obama said he was evidence-based. Arne Duncan says he's evidence-based. They're not. I would just get somebody who's evidence-based in a position of making policy for education. That's what I'd do. And I'd be their minister. I'd be their scientific advisor. I mean, I'm offering to do this. I'm offering to do it for the Oregon governor, which is Kitzhaber.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, I don't get it. I don't know why people don't want to do the right thing.
Is there a follow-up question to that would be that the president, when he came in, said his administration restore science to its
yes.
rightful place.
That's right.
Without giving coordinates of what the rightful place of science is. Do you have some sense of what the rightful place of science is?
Well, it should be the science should be the basis for all decisions that are made. That's its rightful place. And it's been very disappointing to watch this administration play out. For example, I think we spoke about this, but there's something called the Harlem Children's Project,
right.
started by Jeffrey Canada. And Obama so loves that project that he wants to replicate it in 20 cities across this country. There's a book about this project called Whatever It Takes. Paul Tuff talks to Jeffrey Canada about the project. Of course, I bought the book as soon as it came out because I wanted to know all about it.
Right.
So I'm reading. Then on page like 102, it says, oh, yeah, by the way, the children love this project, but compared to their controls, they don't perform any differently on anything, nothing. There isn't a shred of evidence that it works. I slammed the book shut. That's it. Now, it's interesting. I was in the Society for Neuroscience. I was on a program with Heckman, and Paul Tuff was there. And we were having lunch, and I said, somebody mentioned the Harlem Children's Project. And I said, there isn't a shred of evidence that it works. And Heckman and Paul Tuff looked at each other. She knows. Because they had just had a meeting last week, the week before that, to talk about the Harlem Children's Project, to dig around, really dig around and see if there's any evidence for it. There's none. Heckman's dug into this. This is where we got started talking about Heckman. But Heckman really wants to find programs that are effective and then try to convince policymakers. He's tried to talk to the White House about it. They're too busy. You know, they're just too busy for Paul, for Jim Heckman. They're too busy for Paul Krugman. They don't want somebody like that. They have Larry Summers. Come on, he could have had Krugman or Heckman. What's
both,
going on?
Both have amazing reputations, of course. Krugman and Heckman. I mean,
yes.
I've been reading Jim's papers for years. They're very...
He's a wonderful man. I like Jim Heckman a lot. He's just started something that he calls a disparity network. He's just got funding for it.
Right.
He's going to bring together people from different walks of life to work on the gnarly and hugely significant problem of disparity. And I'm on his network. But, and he wants to come to Oregon. So he'll be coming.
I'd like to talk to him sometime. On camera, we'll arrange that.
He's a wonderful man, yeah.
Yeah. So, how did you get into this particular strand of thought here? I mean,
which strand?
Well, I mean, you're using brain imaging.
Mm-hmm.
You're evidence based, and so on and so forth. Are you a strong believer that the kind of evidence that you get from fMRI, for example, is solid? Because there was this debate, of course, about the voodoo science and so on. people overinterpreting and put a picture of a brain on and the public buys it. You know what I mean?
That's true. It's people have shown that in studies. And it's deplorable. And how I really got started, though, was I was a 1968 hippie, see, and I just wanted to reduce inequality, like we all did. And then I just stumbled into a course on the brain function, a primer of neurophysiology, it was, the book. And I couldn't believe that ideas, which I wanted to influence, were cascades of chemicals, electrical chemical storms in people's brains. So I figured I had to know about that. And that's how I got started in neuroscience. But no, I mean, what's true and sensible is that you use every single method you get your hands on. And if all the methods give you pretty much the same answer, then you start believing it. No, I don't believe a one-off fMRI study that says the blob's here and that's what it's for. I'm like, no, wait. Well, let's do it this way, let's look at it that way, let's do electrophysiology, and by the way, let's look at brain damage patients, and I've done all that. When I started, our only neuroimaging technique was the neurological exam. That's how I started. And you can use all these methods, and if they all tell you one thing, then you can start believing it.
Before you actually even thought about neuroscience, was there some stimulus that made you go into science at all? Was it, did you have scientific parents or
my background. We all went to university. That's what we did. And I didn't want to go to university. You know, I was a Marxist, you know. But
this was 68, right?
It's 68. It's like, but
revolution everywhere.
Yeah, I went to the first year. This is at University of British Columbia, and well, I was just involved in political groups. Yeah. We would meet and discuss and plan the revolution on campus. And then I sometimes didn't even sit my exams. I mean, I didn't. And then my father, at the end of that year, he said, oh, I see you really meant that you didn't want to go to university. Okay, I'm not paying anymore. Wait a minute! Because, you know, room and board. So yeah. So I stayed at school and... Well, in between political meetings, I'd take a course on Shakespeare, I took a course on physics, philosophy, and then here's this little class on neurophysiology. I was like, oh, that caught my attention. Yeah, that really caught my attention. So, no, I think you have to use converging methods and at multiple levels of analysis. Animal models, human
right,
models.
But as you look back on that trajectory of yours, which was a bit circuitous, remember that book by Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist? You've had students, you've got students. I mean, what do you tell them? What's your advice to a young student?
I was just thinking about Peter Medawar's book, A Distinct Preference.
Oh, right.
That's what she was thinking. Well, what do I tell them? I tell them, take your time. Take your time. Try everything. Try this, working in this lab, working in that lab, taking that class. Heck, drop out for a year, see how you like developing a second language acquisition program. Take your time, because once you find what it is that you love, your passion, you'll never have to work a day in your life. That's what I tell everybody.
I mean, because then it's just love, it's not work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm work. I mean, they pay me to do this. Like, whoa. Now, no, you know how full circle it is? In 68, I'm saying, look, man, we've got to reduce inequality. This doesn't work, blah, 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 for this and this reason, and furthermore, it doesn't matter. And everybody's like, come on, it's human nature, man, human nature. And now, 30 years later, I'm saying exactly the same thing, and they're paying me to say it. Like last night, they gave me a prize.
Yeah, congratulations.
For saying it. What I was saying in 68, literally. That's the truth.
Why did you, I mean, tell me about the years you spent at UCSD. What were you doing there?
I wasn't at UCSD, I was at Salk.
Well, but also
oh, no, I was a postdoc at UCSD
yeah.
with Steve Hilliard.
Right.
And we, at that time, well, I was a grad student at New York, I mean at Cornell Medical School, in the city. So I was reading the Times one Sunday, and they had this big article about the whale migration. Like, I'm like, whales come down there? You can see them? Yeah. And I was considering where to go for the postdoc. I had three options, and then I was like, that's it. So I went down to work at UCSD. The medical school had its camp. At that time, neuroscience was in a building on the beach. Cool. And then, of course, I got to learn so much from Hilliard and Galambos. That's what I was doing there. And then when I was there, the Salk Institute was looking to hire a senior scientist in the study of humans. Brains or something like that. So they had all these talks. And so I went to every one of them, asked questions. So I always got invited to dinner. So I got to meet, you know, Francis Crick and Floyd Bloom and Ursula and all those guys.
Ursula Bellucci was there, of course, then.
Yeah.
Ursula was there because...
78.
Bronofsky had brought her in, yeah.
Yeah. And so I got to meet all these people and then go to dinner and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then they, at one point, they kind of went,
You're awfully persistent.
Well, I wasn't looking for a job. I mean, I loved being a postdoc. But they thought, well, maybe the idea of getting this big name, expensive, you know, senior person, maybe we should just get her. She's junior, she'd be cheap. She's kind of cute. So that's why they offered me a job. Oh, well, they offered me a position. And I actually had wanted to be a permanent postdoc. I wanted to be always a postdoc with no responsibilities, let somebody else get the grants, you know. And so I had to think really hard about whether I wanted it.
Yeah.
At Salk. And then in the end I said, Ursula kept saying, do you want to be a grown-up now? Are you ready? And I was like, if they give me a lab overlooking the ocean, I'll do it. So I did. I had one.
Yeah.
So then I was at Salk for about 20 years, but
right.
Then I started, you know, at some age you think, you know, I have to start teaching the next generation. So I used to do a bit of teaching at UCSD, but I wanted to do more teaching. And I thought it was important. You see, cognitive neuroscience is really, truly multidimensional and multi-leveled. So if you want to understand anything, like veridically, you know, you do have to study it from all the different perspectives. It's like you must know E.O. Wilson's brilliant book, Consilience.
Yeah.
That's what it is. I mean, if you're going to solve a really hard problem or know anything truly, you have to have lots of input on it. So I was involved in setting up the new department there, cognitive science, in which we had people from philosophy, computer science, neuroscience, psychology, and, you know, all sorts of different disciplines. That was our new department. And so I went over there for 1 year in that new department.
Well, Jeff Ellman would be there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I thought, I mean, it was like going to a third world country compared to Salk. You know? You had to ask for more pencils and shit. The people at Salk, you know, there's four times as many people to serve the scientists as there are scientists. Like, they're there to help you get your research done. That's what it is. That's what it should be like. But if you're at a public university, so I thought, well, if I'm going to be at a public university, I might as well be somewhere beautiful. And that's when I went to Oregon.
So when did you start these studies on these recent studies following the kids?
I was just been doing basic research on brain plasticity until about 7 years ago.
Right.
That's when I started. And I started because at that point, I realized, well, actually, we know quite a bit about neuroplasticity. We know some systems are pretty changeable, some aren't. We know when the ones that are, so forth. And that's when I said, let's do an experiment in the real world.
So which parts of brain are you finding are crucial in this work? You've got changes in certain areas, haven't you, that seem to show up?
Well, the one cognitive process that is important for anything that you want to do to be successful at. For example, if you want to be a better soccer player, you need to be able to focus on the game and suppress distracting information. If you want to learn the cello, whoo, you need this process of attention. If you want to learn math, you need this process of attention. And attention, that's why I say it's a domain general force multiplier. It multiplies everything. And attention is what we're focusing on a lot these days, because we had earlier shown that this selective attention this fast selective attention mechanism that kicks in by a tenth of a second, it's very malleable. It's way enhanced in people who were born deaf, visual attention.
Right.
It's way enhanced in people who were born blind, in auditory attention. And as I mentioned, there are two sides of neuroplasticity. Systems that can be enhanced are also vulnerable to deficit if the inputs aren't just right. And sure enough, lots of kids who have or are at risk for developmental disorders, they have very poor attention, including kids living below the poverty line. So the brain regions important for this kind of attention are the parietal cortex and the dorsal pathway, and then the frontal lobe regions.
We do a lot of conversations with people about the science of educating.
Mm-hmm.
I'm part of the exec of the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center at UCSD. So I talk a lot to people about how to optimize and build better learners.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things keep coming up in conversation with Lauren Frank or with Dave Seeger, or and they talk about the sort of neural correlates of engagement.
Mm.
How do you get people engaged, and what's going on at that point? I mean, is this something that you think about at any time?
I'd have to know more about how you're using the word engaged. I mean, I really carefully define.
I think it was attention is what we're talking about, really. Deep attention. We also talk about being getting into almost an allostatic load kind of story, where you're addicted to learning, where you're in a hyper state, where you're learning better, dopamine's going up, and all sorts of things happening. Can't sustain it, but at least there's an elevated, primed level there where information is being processed at a more acute level.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we do. We give children the control over that engagement so they can turn it on or turn it off.
Yeah.
And that's how we're doing it. We're working with 3, 4, and 5-year-old kids. And we're having a lot of success. I've also worked with 6 to 8-year-old kids and with different paradigms. You can boost it there too.
Yeah.
However, it's a very important question, and it's an empirical question as to when you can't boost that anymore, because we know that after the age of 15, it's not enhanced in people who are blind, for example.
Right.
So sometime between 8 and 15, somebody should look at those years and determine when the cutoff point is.
Yeah. I'm thinking back to the old Bruce McEwen papers, of course, about allostatic load and so on. Mooming Poo and Yang Dan up at Berkeley have been also working with Paula Talal on some of this stuff in terms of mm-hmm. this notion of it being, and Andrea Chiba as well, this whole notion of how can you contrive a state in which people are addicted to learning so that you're improving the classroom experience? I mean, because all of these things go together. Jim Heckman's papers, this is all part of the same conceptual quilt, if you like.
Hmm.
You know, it all has to be stitched together somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that?
We're just what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're all doing our best.
Yeah.
People have to listen, though. Yeah. People have done so much wonderful work, and they are doing wonderful work. Lots of people are working really hard, and many people are doing good work. A lot of people are not doing good work, but let's just talk about the people that are doing excellent work. How do you get people to listen? That's our biggest problem. How do you get people to listen and know what you found out?
So you think there's a breakdown in communication of science to a general public, larger audience?
I would say so. Well, I mean, our national government has been staunchly anti-science. And now Obama says he's not, but I don't see any evidence that anything's different.
you got John Holden there, you got Eric Lander, you've got a lot of people there, you've got Francis Collins, a lot of people who, Hal Varmus. I mean, it should be.
Well, I'm.
On the face of it, looks far more
yeah.
positive than at any time in the last 8 years.
Well, I'm just telling you what I know, which is in the field of education, yeah. in spite of the lip service to evidence-based approaches, they're doing the opposite. I can't speak about Varmus and all that other stuff, but I can tell you, in education, they're not.
But that's what your curve showed, didn't it?
Yeah. So Heckman published in Science magazine, as you know, a curve just showing the rate of return of dollars invested. So let's say the market investment, your rate of return is here. If you invest in early education, it's here. That's better. That's higher. If you invest in school, well, you know. And if you invest in higher education or job training, it's like this. It doesn't make economic sense. That's evidence. It does not make economic sense to not invest in early ed and to invest, over-invest in. And then what I superimposed on Heckman's curve was where we do spend money. And so Heckman's curve is like this. Where we do invest is like this. That doesn't sound like an evidence-based policy-making group to me. That's why I'm saying that.
Yeah. Have you, do you speak to politicians about this sort of thing?
Every chance I can get.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't get that many chances. I mean, they think they know everything.
Yeah.
And who am I?
Well, you have evidence-based research.
I know. But, however, I haven't given up. There's a wonderful quote. I don't know if you know this political philosopher, Gramsci.
Yeah.
Noam
Antonio
Chomsky.
Gramsci.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Noam Chomsky is a good friend of mine. He was just out in Oregon. And he always reminds me of this wonderful quote by Gramsci, who spent most of his life in jail because he kept going up against the establishment. Yeah. And his wonderful quote is, pessimism of the intelligence. We all know it's pretty bad. Optimism of the will. That's how he lived his life. And I keep that quote front and center all the time. For Mother's Day, my son gave me a card and it said, never, never, never give up. Yeah. Keep fighting the good fight, Mom. Cool. So I have good support.
Do you think about, you were talking about will there. Do you actually, having done all this work on the brain, do you think about issues like consciousness and free will?
No. I have too much work to do.
Well, Francis
thought about it. He said it's attention, and it is. That's what it is. That's what consciousness is, I think. Although, probably more complicated than that, but.
I have a couple of
You could ask me my favorite
regular
color
question. No, I have some regular questions I ask everybody just to see what they think.
Okay.
One of them is about, we've done the advice to a young scientist. One of them's about the whole situation of science in society, the history of science, philosophy of science, and it really basically is trying to figure out who your intellectual heroes might have been. So if I gave you a time travel token and allowed you to go and stick it in a machine and bring anybody to your dinner table to have a conversation with, who do you think you'd like to talk to?
Gramsci,
yeah.
Che Guevara. I'm not kidding.
Che Guevara.
Yeah, he did. It worked. I've been to Cuba. It works.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd like E.O. Wilson to dinner, even though he's not dead.
Yeah. Well, Ed is a good conversation.
Yeah.
No question. So on that sense, you see your work as being consilient, don't you? I mean, this is which is what, you know, the Heckman connection and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
What I call a conceptual quilt.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I'm not putting words in your mouth there, am I? No.
No. I mean, it's not as consilient as ultimately it's going to have to be, because, you know, look, I need, if I'm going to understand why people are so resistant to science and evidence, I mean, science, doing an experiment is the only way I know to find out what's true. Poke something, see what happens.
Right,
you know.
Right.
But to find out why people are so resistant to science and abhorrent to science. I was at a meeting 2 weeks ago of people who have programs for disadvantaged children. A head of one of those programs said to me, "Sorry, I just don't believe in science." I was like, whoa, that was very hard for me to be in that atmosphere.
Yeah.
We had to, it was a stupid, anyway, it was a camp up in the mountains. And we all had to have camp names. So these guys were like, "I'm Moonflower, I'm Spirit." And they said, "What's your camp name?" And I said, "Beef." "If you think you have a program that's successful, I want you to show me the beef." So right from the get-go, they were like,
"Who is she?"
Ugh.
Ever the conformist, Helen Neville.
Well, anyway, so to be really conciliant and for what E.O. Wilson would do, you know, you'd have to have sociologists or whoever knows why people are like that.
Yeah.
Why people are resistant to evidence and resistant to science. And I'm not working with any of those guys.
So what would a world look like where you felt like you'd achieved all the ambitions you have rushing around in those neural networks at this point? When would you be satisfied? What would the world look like to make you feel at peace?
Well, I think it would look quite a bit like many societies that already exist. No, societies without the gradient. So societies where everybody has education, good education, and everybody has health care, and everybody has a roof over their head, and everybody has 3 meals a day, and there's true racial integration, and people are doing their best at what they can do best and are rewarded for it like anybody else. And they'd be critical thinkers, and they'd say, "I heard that it's possible if you took a cell from the skin and put it in a dish, you could grow it up to be neurons, and you could put it in the brain, and it could solve Alzheimer's. I heard about this. Is it true?" What I just described to you is exactly how I found Cuba. I have people with no running water saying, "I heard about this." They're talking about stem cell research. You cannot have a discussion with an American about stem cell research because they don't know what it is. You can't have a debate. It's very important to be able to debate issues like in the pub. If you try to debate any important issue, you can't, because they're so uneducated. And it doesn't have to be that way. And I've seen it different.
Well, we do have the stem cell meeting on the Mesa, which you can watch on the Science Network. We've done 5 of them now. So
cool. Well, you know what I'm talking about, don't you?
But in Canada, I would have thought there was an UK. I mean, the communication of science. Canada has, what, Quirks and Quarks are still probably running. There's good science communication programs. David Suzuki's up there still.
It's fantastic.
Presumably.
I'm talking about America. I'm talking about the United States of America, which is starkly different than Europe. There's no question about it. That you still have those steep gradients in the UK. But it's not all over Europe. Sweden, Finland, you know, they're flat gradients. So I think for science communication, I think the States is much worse than all those other countries. I mean, it is. I've experienced it firsthand.
Well, let me ask you on a final note, what are you optimistic about?
Oh, having a world like that.
Okay.
And I am optimistic. I mean, of course I'm optimistic. I wouldn't be doing all this if I didn't think it was going to work.
Yeah.
You're kidding me. Don't you believe me? No, I mean, why wouldn't you think I were optimistic?
Well, you had some reflections there that were, even though there were changes of government, nothing seemed to be happening very, in a very positive sense. So there was a certain...
It's going to.
it has to.
It has to. Well, I mean, actually, well, we're doing what we can to move it all in that direction. And we're telling people about it. And I'm training future generations who are going to work on it. And little by little, it's funny when you reach a tipping point. We could be close to one now for this. But another thing that's going to really help us all, leverage all of this, is, well, the wonderful technology that we have. I am now working with a man who is working hard to get that technology in the hands of poor people around the world, because it's going to transform them, their access to information, their ability to do things. And see, that currently that is something that has further pushed these unequal groups further apart, more disparity, because the high SES guys have all that technology and the low guys don't. There's no reason they shouldn't, because it's so cheap now. You can make a computer this small for $25. Everybody should have that, cell phones, whatever. And so I think that this is going to make a big difference, and this man is doing wonderful work. I'm going to start working with him.
Yeah. Is there somebody we know?
His name is Ray Ramsey. I don't know if you know him.
But it's certainly the case. I was talking at a meeting to one of the guys who's actually officially known as a Google evangelist.
Oh.
And he was telling me about being in Africa.
Yeah.
And how some school official had come up to him and said, could you please give us some big computers and so on, donate some large... And he said, behind this guy, while he was making these entreaties, were a bunch of kids. And they were all already doing this.
Yeah. With
two thumbs up. So they're already doing that kind of stuff. So the more that spreads, it seems to me, the...
Yeah. So I think, anyway, there are a number of people that think the way that we think, and just about everybody kind of embraces what we're saying. If you read it on everybody's website, it's just that they're not doing the work, you know, that you need to do to establish credibility. But I think many people embrace what we care about, and I think that technology is rapidly coming to a point where it can help us do all this. And there are people who want to do this. The nonprofits. This guy Ray Ramsey is all nonprofit. And so I am very optimistic. People in my lab are optimistic. One thing I didn't say last night, this is important, is that young people, well, I mean by, you know, in their 20s, young people, just starting out, you know, they are suffering. They don't have jobs. They don't see much hope. They see Fukushima, they see Libya, they see... non-evidence, but I mean, they see what we see, and they don't have a job, and they don't really see how they could make a difference. For that reason, I have hordes of young people flocking to volunteer in my lab. Young people want something to do that, and people in my lab can see immediately the benefits to the families we work with, and they kind of think, whoa, this could work, hey, this could go. And so I'm going to propose to Arnie Duncan.
Okay.
I'm going to say, let's make a new Peace Corps. And this one, you'll pay young people to do our intervention. We'll give jobs to the young people. They will feel empowered. They will be changing the lives of the poor people. It's going to leverage everything. And that is a fantastic idea.
So you want a science corps in addition to a peace corps?
You don't even have to call it science. Like, we've done the science. They can just implement what we found out.
Yeah.
Not a science corps. It's a family. What do you call it? What do you think you'd call it?
Consilience corps.
That's good. Well, anyway, that's what I'm going to propose, in addition to giving money so everybody can have a copy of our DVD, changingbrains.org, and so we can translate it to Spanish and give it to those families.
All right.
That's what I'm going to, that's I'm just starting my list now for Arnie.
This is what you're optimistic about.
Everything. There's a lot to be optimistic about.
All right. We'll visit you again and see how it's going. Helen Neville, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.